Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. If you're new to our podcast, we encourage you to go back and listen to some of our previous guests that we've had over the last few years. And this week, we're happy to have Ralph Boyd joining us as a guest. And Greg Lehman, who has recently joined our firm, is going to introduce him today.
It's a pleasure to be joining you on this podcast. I've, as you mentioned in an earlier podcast, I was your first podcast subject, and then a second one about a month or so ago. So it's a real privilege for me this morning to introduce a board colleague at InfuSystem and a friend and a great leader, a gentleman by the name of Ralph Boyd. And I feel like I've known Ralph for many years, but actually I met him in 2022 when he joined the InfuSystem Board of Directors. Ralph, in his capacity at InfuSystem, is chairman of the Compensation Committee, which is probably the most difficult committee of any because it revolves around compensation.
He's in the history of the sentient universe, Greg.
Yeah. Well, and I was former chairman of the comp committee, and so I've walked in his moccasins. But he's also a member of a committee that I chair, which is the Corporate Nominating and Governance Committee. And but Ralph has a really extensive experience, really walking in both the for-profit and not-for-profit sectors. And he is an attorney, so we'll have to be careful that we don't ask him anything that he can't tell us. He was a federal prosecutor and assistant attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice, and he's currently CEO of SUM, Inc., a large Washington, D.C.-based housing development, healthcare, human services organization, and I'm sure he's got some really great stories there, and regional CEO of the American Red Cross. So in addition to practicing law, he's been working as a director at DirecTV Group, formerly a NASDAQ public company, and as a member of the, I think it's audit and NomGov, is that right?
That's right. Chaired audit for several years.
Yeah. And then I'll conclude by saying Ralph is chair of the Sandy Spring Bancorp Compensation Committee and is a member of the Executive and Non-Governance Committee there as well, and also non-executive chairman of the NHP Foundation, which I believe, Ralph, if I recall, developer, owner, and operator of multifamily affordable housing. Did I get that right?
You nailed it. That's a mouthful and you got it, Greg.
All right. Well, Ralph is also a graduate of Haverford College and a little known school called Harvard Law School. So with that, Mark, I'll turn it back to you to kick off our podcast.
Yeah. Well, Ralph, could you give us just, I always ask people to give just a quick overview. Greg did a great introduction as far as just some of your, but give us a little bit of your career story of how you got from kind of early on to where you are today. I would love to hear that personal story.
Yeah, I'm happy to tell it. I'll try to keep it in under 3 hours.
Okay, well, good.
I come from a family. My dad, when he got back from World War II, was wounded in Italy in the Second World War, came back and worked in the factory at GE for 50 years. And he and my mom were civil rights activists in upstate New York. And I think so. I grew up, a lot of kids grew up watching television. I grew up out playing football out on the football fields and then sitting in endless meetings with my parents. So at a young age, got pretty used to hearing people talk about serious issues and kind of engaging with adults on those serious issues. And so shouldn't be surprising that coming from that kind of a family, I always had as part of my, at that point, unarticulated ethos was to want to make a difference, to do things that made things better for people. And as I've matured as an adult, that's kind of crystallized. And if I were to kind of summarize a now many decades long resume, what courses through that resume is me constantly trying to strike a balance between doing those things professionally that will advance others, that'll give, I'm stealing from that old Army commercial now, give every person a full and fair opportunity to be all he or she can be. Doing that, believing everybody has a right and we have an obligation to help everybody optimize themselves, if you will, balance that with also providing for my family in a way that they're comfortable. And so that my, you know, happy wife, happy life, but also so my kids can just simply focus on their own lives and making sure that they are focused on the development and betterment of self, and also developing those values about their relation to their world and their community, and not worry about where the next dollar is coming from or a roof over their heads or those kinds of things. So balancing the desire to create a comfortable living platform for my family with all, while also, as my wife would say sometimes to me mockingly, trying to save the world. At times when I was too long into my save the world gigs, she would say, "Hey, when are you going to turn to saving the Boyd family for a while?" So that's why you see the bounce back and forth between the corporate world, the law firm world, the nonprofit sector, and government. I was a federal prosecutor for a decade in Boston doing prosecuting homicides and organized crime. If you've seen the movie The Departed, a lot of Whitey Bulger's guys in there, I did those guys. And so one aspect that's not on my resume is I walked around with a hip holster with a 9mm for 10 years. The marshals figured it was easier to train me and arm me than give me a detail all the time. So that was not inconsistent with my personality. The fact that I wanted to save the world didn't mean I was meek about it in any way. So if you look at everything from being a federal prosecutor, had the privilege of being a partner in a large Boston law firm, or running various nonprofit organizations, it all focuses on trying to make things better for people, thinking that everybody has a right to kind of be the best they can be. And while it's not a legal right, it's certainly, I think, a moral obligation of a civil society, one that articulates the values that ours does and our culture. It's our obligation to give people the tools they need, not to do it for them, but to give them the tools and the training and the support and the uplift they need to get it done for themselves and their families and their communities. And I think when you do that effectively, I always tell folks it's great because it has great radiating horizontal consequences that are favorable and great vertical consequences too. The horizontal meaning you change the life of one person who's at risk or under-optimized, you don't just change that person, you change their family's trajectory, you change the community that they're in. So it has all of these rippling consequences horizontally throughout the culture. But the vertical piece is, and this is especially when you're dealing with people who are experiencing poverty or homelessness or whatever, you change the trajectory of their lives. It's an intergenerational impact, right? I mean, poverty is almost genetic at some point, in that if a child is born into an impoverished family, the likelihood of them staying there is much greater than for somebody who isn't, and then the subsequent generations that follow. So helping people fix themselves and advance themselves in the moment and change their life trajectories. And when I say change the trajectories, I mean in a material way, I mean in a physical way, I mean in an emotional way, and even in a spiritual way, is what we ought to be about. At the end of the day, it's in all our best interest to take good care of self, but also to take good care of others. To quote Tim McGraw, humble and kind is part of what this resume is about, as well as, the selfish part is doing well for myself. And as I said, for my immediate family, happy wife, happy life.
So if you were able to spin back time and talk to that 22-year-old Ralph, what advice would you give him?
I would be explicit about kind of where I've tumbled to in life, which is to embrace different opportunities. Throughout my youth, and I didn't say this, I initially thought I was going to be a Navy pilot, but by 16, it was pretty clear that my eyes weren't going to allow that. So I transitioned to, I'll be a lawyer and save the world that way. But along the way, I realized there's lots of ways to quote unquote save the world or pieces of the world. And I would have urged my 22-year-old self to be explicit about what I've ended up doing, which is when a door or window open of opportunity, step through it. If somebody had told me that at my tenure, I would not have practiced law for a decade and a half and be very happy at doing it and be, feel like I'm amplifying myself a lot more in what I'm doing now, I would have been shocked by that, because for so many years and decades, even my self-image was as a litigator, trial lawyer, whatever, and whether that was a prosecutor or in private practice or whatever. So I would encourage having an open mind about professional opportunities going forward. I've joked about this sometimes. I've been on so many corporate and national nonprofit boards. I think the law school me would have looked at this me and said, who the hell is that guy, man? Who's that establishment dude? Burn his house down. So I would have the conversation I would have with myself then is embrace the broad range of professional opportunities that may be available to you, and be very purposeful in your learning so that your learning allows you to avail yourself of those different opportunities that will come along. I didn't see myself, you know, 40 years ago or 30 years ago where I am now. And I ended up here, but I guess if I were talking to the 22-year-old me, I would say, hey, be purposeful about considering and preparing yourself for a broad range of opportunities, be purposeful in your leadership learning and development experiences, because leadership matters. Leadership's decisive.
So on that note, Ralph, a follow-up question to that relative to leadership. Tell us a little bit about your leadership style and how you engage your team, that your direct reports. How do you engage them in terms of your leadership style and help them be all they can be?
Great question, Greg. So I'll describe my leadership style as some others described it as kind of a people-focused leadership style, in that I'm not a Jack Welch disciple in all respects, but I am in many. And one of the respects I'm a Jack Welch disciple is Jack preached constantly when he was building GE into the market capital monster he did. Jack always said, people and talent are decisive. Capital is important. Access to capital at the right price point, strategy are important. But at the end of the day, if you'll excuse my French, Jack said, talent will kick capital's ass in the marketplace every day. So you want all three, right? You want talent, you want capital, and you want good strategy. But if you had to pick one, you'd pick talent. Because I've always said, give me great people and give me nothing else and I'll still win almost all the time. So that's kind of my view. So my view is to be really focus on deliberative and collaborative decision-making. I try very hard around here, around my organization, to not govern by executive fiat, as I like to say. If it is executive fiat, it's dispersed across several people, several different lines of service, and several different personalities and flavors of leader. I won't shock you, do a little bit of speaking and writing about the value of diversity and inclusion and whether it really matters in terms of performance and outcomes for organizations. And I've concluded both anecdotally and through study that it does. And what it requires is it requires an appreciation of, in a way, of taking advantage of difference in the leadership shop. So I'm just not looking for us to be diverse in terms of our identity, our immutable traits, our race, gender, orientation, all that stuff. Diversity at its most essential core is diversity of thought, right? Thinking styles, ways of doing things, perspectives, backgrounds. That's where the value of and better problem solving and decision making comes in. So I try to have a very, if you looked at my senior leadership team, you would just, well, from an identity perspective, you'd say it was diverse, but you'd have to sit in on our meetings and hear the different thinking styles, the folks who are all data driven versus the folks who tend to be emotive. And then people like me who try to mix both, try to get the data right and then analytics right, but also understand the human emotion and the inspiration piece that are required. So it's a people-focused style. We spend a lot of time and attention on discerning what leadership opportunities exist in the moment that will advance the learning and the leadership chops of our team. And with a specific emphasis on them specifically cultivating the people coming behind them. So we spend a great deal of time identifying talent down the pipeline, if you will, figuring out who the emerging leaders are and what we can do to advance them in terms of their subject matter expertise, their technical skills, their management skills, and then their overall leadership chops. We spend a lot of time on it, believing that great leaders throughout the organization will optimize our effectiveness, because we're a big nonprofit. We've got about $750 million balance sheet, but we're always on the edge with issues, whether it's public safety, whether it's cost of capital in a rapid inflation environment, or in an environment where some of the government subsidies have hit their caps. So there's a lot of triage and problem solving that's got to go on. And I need the smartest, most agile people who are deeply committed, who believe in the mission, but also believe in the blocking and tackling that's required to execute that mission, very often in a suboptimal context, very often when capital may be challenged, talent may be challenged, our environment. You know this, Greg, because you've been on some calls with me when I've said, I got to jump off. We just had a shooting downstairs. I mean, literally those kinds of issues for us. So my counsel to that 22-year-old would be train for everything and be prepared for anything.
Yeah. Good. That was very helpful, Ralph. Thank you.
And what I tell my kids all the time is, in a world that wants to give everybody participation trophies, the truth is you don't get trophies for knowing less. You get trophies for knowing more. So know as more about as many different things as you can, but nail the stuff you got to know to do the space you're in as well as you can do it. And that's probably one of my biggest takeaways is I've had a lot of, as my resume reflects, I've had a lot of great gigs in my life, but none of them were specifically planned. Many of them were opportunities that arose because of what people saw me doing in the current moment in my current gig. And so, you know, there are those folks that go out there and they're in their current job and they're already planning for the next one or positioning for the next one. I don't do that. My view is if I kill the moment, people will see it, and whatever great opportunities that are out there will avail themselves or reveal themselves, and I'll try to avail myself of those opportunities. But I am a planner, but I'm not calculating three moves ahead. I live the moment and try to just really max out the moment in terms of what we can achieve with clear objectives. And, you know, you start nailing objectives, people notice.
Yep.
So thinking back to that first leadership position that you had, talk a little bit about just some of the things that as a new leader is important to focus on in that first you know, 90-day window, that first year, what are some things that you would say to a new leader as they're moving into a new role?
Yeah, I'll try to answer that in under an hour. So let me just give a little background, since the context will help understand what I'm going to say here. So my first real leadership gig in my professional life was when I was an assistant U.S. attorney in Boston, and I was in the major crimes unit, and I showed up there one day and just decided that Boston was too violent and I was going to change that. Yeah, I wasn't too full of myself. The funny thing is, we actually did. So Boston was in the middle of, this was in the early 1990s, when Boston, like the District of Columbia and other major cities, was hit with a lot of the violence that attended to the crack cocaine trade. That's when crack was really getting a foothold in urban America and the violence that went with it. Boston's homicide rate was approaching, this was in 1990, was approaching 200 homicides, which felt like a war zone to people. And so we developed this program called Operation Trigger Lock in Boston. And the idea was, a lot of the violence in Boston was gang related, was to just start taking out the gangs. And I decided I was going to do that. Eventually, we created a much more comprehensive program in Boston that became known as the Boston Project. And it had a law enforcement piece that I led on the prosecution side, but it also involved, it was this weed and seed concept. Law enforcement can take out the bad guys, but then unless there is some social focus on once you've taken out the weeds, planting fresh seeds so new weeds don't replace them. So there was a social service component to it, which was filled in by the social work community and related communities. The faith community stepped into that space as well. And then the mayor's human services folks walked into that space. And then the business community stepped up and said, hey, we've got a role here. What should we be doing? And so the idea was, I would take out the bad guys and then lay the foundation for identifying and addressing the issues facing at-risk young people as early as 8 and 10 years old, before they got into the gang life for all the reasons that they did, and start kind of turning them somewhere else in a more productive way. But with respect to the law enforcement piece, the great news was I had a ton of resources. I had the Boston Police Homicide, I had the drug unit, I had the anti-gang violence unit. And then I had the FBI, the ATF, the DEA. So I had all these resources, which is great. Only problem with is no one wants to work with the FBI. Nobody else in law enforcement wanted to work with the FBI. And in law enforcement, since no one's getting rich doing that work, the currency is credit. Who's getting credit for good things happening? So, and then how do you get all these different agencies with, you know, slightly different agendas and perspectives about objectives to kind of work together in a way that's collaborative, cooperative, and share credit? Sounds like not a big deal, but it was a huge cultural lift, and probably spent the first 2 years of the Boston Project just trying to cultivate the relationships and the culture. And one of the things, this is one thing I'd say for leaders, one of the things I came to believe early on, and I'm not even sure how I stumbled on it, I think by accident, and I saw that it worked, and then it became purposeful. But it's this: for leaders to be very quick to give credit to others and very reticent to assign blame when something goes wrong. Take the blame, give the credit. You do that enough times, it inspires people, because you start piling up wins and people feel like they're on the, you know, you're winning, you know, you're winning the NBA title or the NHL title, the Super Bowl, everybody's happy, right? Everybody's a hero. So part of it was to convince people that we could win, to chalk up some early wins, give generous credit for it. When something went wrong, I'd take the responsibility for it and we'd move on. Eventually started chalking up wins and then doing major things. The upshot is that within 5 years, we took homicides from between 160 and 200 a year down to under 25. And the world saw it. And I always say, if anything ever launched me, it was that. It's the one thing I've done in my life that I did well, but I actually got more credit for it than I deserved. It really was the work of literally hundreds of people. But on the law enforcement side, a lot of the credit at the end of the day ended up in my lap. And I probably got more credit than I deserved. But part of it is, you know, reaping what you sow. If you're sowing, giving credit, the reality is, that karma train backs up to you in a good way very often. So I tell people to trust when you've got a good process and a good and faithful heart, and you're executing well, trust the outcomes and trust how the outcomes will serve you at the end of the day. You don't have to be self-serving. If you're getting outcomes, you know, the world will figure it out at some point. But you got to inspire people, and you do that by being very clear about what the objectives are, making sure people understand the resources they have to achieve those objectives, and then make sure they do, and give generous credit, and, you know, take the hit when something goes wrong, not in a fake way, but just, you know, deflect the attention when things are negative back on yourself and not on the folks who are out in the field, actually get out in the field or in the factory or in the clinic getting the work done.
So what are some of the mentors that you've had in your life that you look to as far as great leaders?
I'm really glad you asked that question. And because one of the things I would say is any success I've had in life, and I've had a little bit, is directly attributable to somebody along the way deciding I'm worth investing in and kind of grabbing me and moving me forward. So, you know, it really started with my admission to college at Haverford. When I was a teenager, I'm afraid to say I saw myself playing corner in the NFL more than I saw myself doing anything that I've done. And so when it came time for college, I wasn't really thinking about having the most challenging academic experience I could have. So I ended up interviewing at Haverford, and at the time their median SAT scores were 750 verbal and 780 math, and let's just say mine were close to that. And so I thought, well, I got no shot here. But my mom had her heart set on that place for what she knew about it, and so I figured, I'll just go through the process for mom, it won't work. And then stunningly, I got in. I was the most shocked person on the planet. And then I was like, oh, no, I want to go to Northeastern and play football. And everybody was saying to me around, oh, you got this great opportunity to go to this great school. You better go. And I was like, yeah. And then one day I was in the locker room, my football locker room in high school, and still reticent about choosing Haverford. And this guy named John Liss, who was a 6'5", 250 pound defensive end on our team, who was one of the meanest people I'd ever met at that point. He and I are in the locker room by ourselves, and he comes over to me snarling, and I'm a little concerned. And he looks at me and goes, "You effing idiot." I said, "What's that all about, man?" He goes, "You got a chance to do something none of the rest of us can. You better effing do it, you jackass." And I thought to myself, holy cow, that's the Lord speaking to me. If John Liss thinks that I should go there, that's the Lord speaking. I should probably go if that guy thinks this is important. So I went, and, you know, it was life changing for me, really challenged me academically and put me on a pretty different path. So I won't say my first mentor was John Liss. It wasn't, but the mentor was the admissions dean at Haverford, who had already a reputation for finding what they call diamonds in the rough. He was almost viewed as this mystical character who could find people who no one else had great confidence in, bring them in and lift them up. And that's surely what he did to me. And then my first specific mentor in school at Haverford was my advisor, a guy named Al Williams, African-American guy, 6'4", 220, former Marine Corps karate champion. He was my first karate instructor. So I've done I've done MMA, karate, jiu-jitsu, the whole nine yards. And it started with Al. What he also happened to be was a PhD in political science and also a lawyer, JD from the University of Virginia. And Al taught me that there is no substitute for rigor. And he rode me for all 4 years. And he was my thesis advisor. My thesis was 127 pages. His thesis advisor comments were 96 pages, single space pages. There were so many red footnote marks on my thesis. I almost needed sunglasses to look at his remarks. But so Al kind of moved my sense of what's required and rigor to the next level. And then in my professional life, Wayne Budd was the U.S. attorney when I applied to the U.S. attorney's office in Boston, which is one of the hardest jobs on the planet for a young lawyer to get. And he pulled me in and encouraged me every step of the way, gave me more responsibility than probably good judgment would have suggested I should have gotten. First week I was in the office, walked in my desk, dropped a file on my desk and said, hey, this case goes to trial next Monday. You up to it? Usually you take a couple months to prepare for a trial. And of course, being the macho jerk I was, I said, oh, of course I would. Why wouldn't I? And then as I got into the case and realized all the problems with it, I was like, but Al kept coming into my office. Oh, excuse me. Wayne kept coming into my office saying, just do it. Don't worry about perfect. Do the best you can by Monday and just do it. And all along the way, he did everything he could to lift me up and advance my career. And eventually, some years later, when President Bush was looking for an assistant attorney general, Wayne and some others made sure I came to his attention. And one thing led to another, and boom, there I was in Washington. So, and then, working for Attorney General Ashcroft, some people We'll see some irony in this. I don't. He and I hit it off really well. And I always tell people he was one of the best bosses I ever had. Took seriously my dissent when I had it, which was much less often than I thought it would be when I went there. And allowed me to turn the train around a few times when the train needed to be turned. And I think what I learned from him and frankly from the president was to how to take criticism with grace. Attorney General Ashcroft was often vilified by the media, as was the president. And I think their vilification bothered me a lot more than it bothered either of them, not because they were arrogant, but because, you know, they knew what they were about. They had a strong sense of self and, they'd learned how to not take stuff personally and understand that, you know, being mocked didn't say anything about them. It said something about the people mocking them. And that reminded me that there is actionable grace in life, and actionable grace is, you know, being acting with dignity under pressure that would cause a lot of people to kind of lose some dignity. So, and I think as a leader, especially as a CEO, modeling dignity and grace is part of what you're doing to develop that talent and the kind of culture you want, where people understand what's expected of them in terms of how they carry themselves, and both in how they treat others and also in how they accept treatment. I think, and so that was good modeling for then. And now I still, now even though I'm a grandpa, I still have a mentor. In my current gig, one of the corporate advisory board members is a guy named Tom Donahue. You may have heard of, the longtime CEO of the U.S. Chamber, who's decided that he's going to make sure that I succeed in this role. And he's got a lot of levers to pull to make that happen. And I'm just trying to make sure I don't disappoint him along the way. So, so part of my message here is mentoring matters. And so I've tried to do the same thing. I've got a zillion proteges down the pipeline, and I'm happy to say that three of them themselves are CEOs today, one of a small public company, one of a very large quasi-governmental CDI that probably distributes between $200 and $300 million a year into the marketplace. So, so I think anybody who says they've done it all on their own is full of it, in my view. There's no way to win without people helping you and being amenable to that help. And then making it worth their while by knocking the cover off the baseball when they get you somewhere.
I always love to get people's ideas and books that they recommend. And especially as a leader, I'm sure you're recommending books to your staff as well as to others. And I know you're teaching also at Georgetown.
So thanks for asking. So I think a must read for leaders is Adam Grant's Give and Take, where he talks about it's his evaluation, both statistical and anecdotal evaluation of what styles and priorities succeed the most in the workplace and in the capital markets in particular. The leaders who are net takers or the leaders who are net givers, and what are the variables around that drive the success of one or the other. And it's a very interesting book with a lot of data, but also a lot of stories that are illuminating. Adam's conclusion is that the net givers are the ones that ultimately do the most and do the best in the business world, which is counterintuitive to a lot of people. It's not to me, but it is to a lot of people. Another book is Malcolm Gladwell's David and Goliath. And I urge people to read that because it's a story about overcoming. He tells a number of stories about people who just crushed it in their professional lives and had to overcome incredible barriers to do it. It's kind of like succeed no matter what. No excuses, succeed. And the stories he tells are so powerful. One that blew me away was the one he told about David Boies. I don't know if that name's familiar to the two of you, but David Boies is when I was in law school, was widely viewed as the best overall litigator in all of America. He argued Bush v. Gore on behalf of Al Gore, with Ted Olson arguing for President Bush. But turns out David Boies is severely dyslexic and doesn't read. And when I heard that, I was like, you've got to be kidding me. All we lawyers do is read and talk. How can you even be passable being almost a non-reader, let alone the best litigator in America? So it's a great exegesis on just find a way. If you can't find a way, make a way. And the ways that, you know, the workarounds that these people did to overcome severe disabilities, handicaps, impediments, whatever you want to call it, is just, I found it really inspired me. And then Jack Welch, who just talks about the ingredients of building stuff and his obsessive focus on cultivating talent, evaluating, cultivating talent. And I think you may know that GE spent decades, building a leadership development team and pipeline and approach. I had the opportunity to go to their leadership school in Crotonville, New York, for a while, and it was illuminating. I mentioned Christine Porath, the professor at the McDonough School at Georgetown, who I do that leadership work with. She's written a number of books. One's called Mastering Civility and the other's called Mastering Community Within the Workplace. And it's her discussion of how civility and a sense of community create cultures that are more productive, that are better outputs in terms of volume and quality, qualitative and quantitative output. And then Arthur Ashe's book, Days of Grace, it's his memoirs. And I'd encourage people to read the last chapter in the book, which is his letter to Kamara, his daughter, where before he passes away, the letter is just telling her everything he wants her to know about living her best life, the things that are valuable, why they're valuable, whether it's faith, whether it's love of the arts and music, whether it's health and wellness, whatever. It's just, I think it's a roadmap for personal optimization and wellness for anybody to read, as well as pretty moving, a father trying to write something so that he will be there with his daughter as she grows into maturity, even though he won't be. I first read that when I was a federal prosecutor, and I had had so many death threats at that point that the marshals were taking my kids to school and back. And as I said, they armed me instead of giving me a detail. Figured that was easier. But the point is that the possibility that I might not be around forever was real. So that letter really prompted me to talk to my kids, and I copied it and gave it to my wife and said, if anything ever happens to me, a lot of what he says is exactly what I think. So just give it to the girls and make sure they know it as they mature. So those would be the things that I would suggest people look at. Another book by Adam Grant is Think Again. And that's where he's talking about the power of learning from being wrong and embracing being wrong. Don't recoil at the prospect of being wrong. Rejoice in it and learn from it is basically the message. So
yeah,
I'm pretty much in.
Yeah. Great suggestions. And definitely put those on your list. I like to hear, and I've got two more questions for you as we close up, but what do you do outside of work to recharge? I think I heard a couple things that you enjoy doing.
So as Greg would tell you, I'm kind of a gym nut. So I'm in the gym all the time, and I'm also a runner. I've done the Boston Marathon 5 times. I'm a little old. I probably won't do that anymore. I don't think neuroskeletally that's a great idea as you advance in years. It's kind of hard on the body, but I will do some of those Spartan races and stuff. So fitness, I'm a soccer referee. No, and I didn't play soccer growing up. I was an outside linebacker. But my daughter played Division I college and then played 3 years after college. So her soccer led me to getting into refereeing. One day at one of her games, I was a little loud with one of the referees. He walked over with the whistle and stuck it in my face and said, "You think you can do better?" And I thought to myself, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can." So I did.
That's great.
So I've reffed all the way from U8s all the way up to college. So, I do that too. And I love that. Fitness and reffing and family are a lot of what I do. I now have 2 grandchildren, and my son-in-law is a Marine Corps captain and did 3 tours in Afghanistan. So I spent a lot of time heading down to Camp Lejeune, where my daughter was, trying to fill in for him when he was gone. And also trying not to show them how freaked out I was by what was going on. So I think that kind of captures it.
Good. Well, this has been a lot of fun. Any parting advice for a newer up and coming leader?
Yeah. Expect what you don't expect to go wrong, and view problem solving in a Churchillian way. And by that, I mean, view problems and crises and challenges as opportunities to excel, embrace them. I mean, Churchill got bombed every single day for an entire year and held that country together and probably saved the world in the process. So view crisis as opportunity, opportunity to prove yourself, to prove your team. I'm really one of those believers that strength really does grow out of adversity. It doesn't grow out of settled comfort. It'd be nice if it did, but it doesn't in my experience. So I think some of the biggest leaps forward that I've taken is when I've gone, an old football term would say, is I got my nose wet, sticking it into a problem.
Well, this has been fun, as well as I know it's going to be helpful for those listening, and appreciate your insights and wisdom, and definitely wish you continued success in your nonprofit leadership role, as well as all everything else that you're doing. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark. And thank you, Greg.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.